passion and pageantry of college football lives here. This is the Paul Feinbaum Show, Hour 2 Podcast.
This might be college football heaven.
And we welcome back. Welcome all of you back. We were here yesterday talking a lot about what happened at Mississippi State with the firing of Zach Arnett. We'll try to get a little closer perspective here from Stefan Krasniak from the Clarion Ledger. Thanks for being here, Stefan. Good to see you again. And when we saw you, I don't know, early in the season, I don't think we really anticipated what would happen. It happened yesterday. Give us the lay of the land in Starkville right now.
Yeah, I think it was something, you know, especially since y'all were in town, that you could tell things were changing. And at the end of the day, Mississippi State just wasn't winning enough. And I think the game at Texas A&M, you know, and before that was the homecoming game against Kentucky, where Mississippi State wasn't too competitive. You can kind of tell that, you know, it was time for Mississippi State to go in a different direction. And, you know, really what was interesting is that they did it now instead of at the end of the regular season. But aside from that, it really wasn't too surprising of a move. You know, when you look at the contract situation and how, you know, easy of a buyout, you know, situation this is for Mississippi State, everything was in place for them to make this move, and they did. And now, you know, athletic director Zach Selman's got a chance to kind of make a big splash, his first big move, you know, since being hired here in January. And you know, coaching searches are always crazy, but I think this is one where Mississippi State, you know, kind of needs to land a good coach, a successful coach, and put themselves in a better position, you know, going forward with the opening of the early signing period and the portal and things of that nature.
Stefan, is there any roadmap to Zach Selman other than we know he was at Oklahoma under Joe Castiglione when they hired Lincoln Riley? Of course, he did. You know, one of the assistants out there at the time was Shane Beamer. There's connections to Starkville. I'm not suggesting Shane Beamer. I know he swatted that away today. But can you give us an idea of where you think, based on what you know about Selman, the direction he may go?
Yeah, I think, you know, considering what Mississippi State, you know, did last year, and they were kind of, you know, obviously forced into the situation of, you know, promoting Zach Arnett. But I think, you know, what they saw with this situation is I would be surprised if they didn't go after a sitting head coach. You know, Zach Selman in his press conference yesterday said that, you know, he has no preference. It could be a sitting head coach. It could be an offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator. He kind of, you know, didn't really show us too much. But I'd be surprised if they didn't try to get someone who, you know, has been in that head coach shoes before, knows how to build a culture, build a program. Guys like, you know, Jamie Chadwell, Lance Leopold, you know, those names are already coming up and a lot of the hot boards and things of that nature. That's the direction that I would expect them to go. Obviously, you got big names, you know, in the coordinator realm too, guys like Jeff Levy, who, you know, are going to get some interest and certainly are worth a phone call. But the sitting head coach, you know, side is where I would expect them to go at this point, just because of, you know, what this program kind of needs after, you know, a few months here of having a guy who was in his, you know, first stint as a head coach.
In terms of the finances, you know, it wasn't a big buyout, but it's still a couple of $1 million. I believe, and you understand this better than I do, that you're going to have to pay off a staff for at least another year. It's expensive. This is not this is not Texas A&M. So how does Mississippi State deal with the financial aspect?
Yeah, it's interesting to say that, you know, a $4.5 million buyout isn't that much because we've been talking about a $75 million buyout. But I think, you know, $4.5 million is still a lot of money. But, you know, Zach Arnett's contract is structured in a way where, you know, he's owed 1.5 annually from Mississippi State. But if he gets a job elsewhere, let's say he gets a, you know, decent defensive coordinator job again somewhere that pays him, you know, $1 million to $1.5 million, that would subtract from what Mississippi State owes him. So there's a chance where, at least, you know, the Zach Arnett perspective of it, Mississippi State could get out of this without having to pay too much annually. So they're in a spot where they're probably rooting for Zach Arnett to land at a pretty good place and help them pay off that buyout a bit.
In relation to how big can they swing, the past, the coaches have been obviously Leach. He's the biggest name coach we've seen there in recent history. Moorhead, clearly an assistant coach who was trending up, but you have to go pretty far back. Jackie Sherrill, probably the last big name coach other than Leach that Mississippi State has brought in. I'm not saying history will indicate where the program goes now, but you mentioned Leipold. I mean, is there a model, or is it just whoever Zach Selman lands on?
Yeah, I think the top thing is, knowing Mississippi State, you have to get a coach that, can recruit well and has shown an ability to, develop players, right? This isn't a program that's landing, five stars left and right, right? You need a coach who's shown that he can bring in a staff that can take a three-star and get success out of it. And I think that's where, a coach like someone like Jamie Chadwell out of, the G5 level has shown, they could succeed with maybe a lesser talent pool, would have success at a place like Mississippi State. So, going back to what I was saying earlier about an acting head coach, Lance obviously has experience at the Power 5 level, but I think Mississippi State, it wouldn't be bad for them if they went, the G5 route and found, head coach from there. I keep bringing up Jamie because, he's the talk of Twitter right now and the Photoshops and whatnot going out there. But I think, he's a guy that would have success at Mississippi State just because he's shown, he can win wherever he's been at. So it's a guy like that I think would have success at Mississippi State just because if you look at the talent pool they have, you need a guy who can develop players. I think him and his staff have shown an ability to do that in the past.
It was interesting in Chadwell because, he was at Coastal for so long. His name came up everywhere. He finally made that move. What is your – give us your read on would he take this job?
I think it's definitely something he would consider. I mean, it's an SEC job. When you look at, the changing landscape of the sport, as soon as next year and the realignment and things of that nature, you want to be in the Big Ten or the SEC or the Big 12, right? I mean, that's the spots where you want to land and continue, working your way up. Now, does he think that maybe if he waits, he can get a better, Power 5 job? That's, that's something that I don't know that he would know and those close to him would know. But I think, for a guy who's, been at the G5 level for a few years now, I think the opportunity of being, in the SEC is definitely something that, should appeal to him. And I think it's a good chance for Mississippi State to make a splash. And I think that's part of why, Mississippi State decided to make this move now, right? Zach Selman was saying he wanted a jolt of energy in the program, at least for these last two games and, pending a bowl game for them. But I think number one is you kind of get ahead on the search and kind of put your name in there first with guys like Chadwell. Just because it, in a few weeks there's probably going to be a lot more openings, a lot more competition for some of those coaches.
Stefan Krasniak talking about the Mississippi State search. Thank you, Stefan. We'll keep up to date with what is happening in Starkville as we head to the break right now. More of your phone calls, a number of guests continue here. We are coming right back.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
We're back. Let's get back to the phone calls here after a number of interviews. And Frank is in Georgia. Hey, Frank.
Hey, Paul. Thanks so much for taking my call. Always try and call you. I mean to call you every November 14th, and I wait too long and can't get through. So this time I thought I'm going to get through. Even though I'm an Alabama fan, I went to Marshall University. And 53 years ago tonight, I was standing on a street corner hitchhiking in the rain. It looked like maybe 100 emergency vehicles went by me and ran to a friend's house and found out that the plane carrying the Marshall football team had just crashed. And I was actually a freshman in that class. And I just kind of want to remember, I don't really have a question, just kind of want to remember those
Frank,
players.
I appreciate you bringing that up. And I've been around long enough to remember it. In fact, I've talked to my good friend Jim Donnan about that a number of times. He coached at Marshall, as you may know, in the 90s.
Oh, yeah.
And he told me how they remembered it every year in November. And it's really one of, and I realize that people have seen the movie. It's still one of the saddest moments in college football history.
It was. Yeah, it really was. And I think something like 26 children lost both parents. I never realized how many alumni traveled with those teams. And, I had classmates that lost both parents, on that flight. But
I don't think as many. There was another crash, I think, in the same I think Wichita State had a football crash maybe before or after that, and there have been some basketball crashes. But, I mean, this is probably the one that is talked about the most, and I appreciate you bringing it up. It's a lot of young people probably may have seen the movie, even though the movie hasn't been came out many years ago. But it's still worth remembering, and thank you very, very much, Frank. It's always good to talk to you, even on a very terrible moment in history. Ricky is in Louisiana. Hello, Ricky.
Hey, Paul. How you doing today?
We're doing great. Thank you.
Oh, I just wanted to call and talk to you today about this Jimbo Fisher situation we got going on down there in College Station. You know, I'm hearing a lot of swirling about these big names that are wanting to hire. You know, I'm hearing Deion Sanders, Lane Kiffin, even Dan Lanning. Paul, I just don't think that's the direction they need to go in.
Okay, Ricky, what would you do if we gave you the keys?
Well, you give me the keys, Paul. I'm going after Coach. Maybe not quite as proven, you know, but I want a guy that cares about ball. You know, these coaches these days at these big schools, all they want to do is bring in the recruits. They're worried about money, all this, all that. A&M's going to bring in the recruits now, Paul. That NIL money they got down there, kids are going to come. I think you just need to bring in a coach who's going to come in and care about ball. And the good coach I think would be good for that spot is Rich Rodriguez. I mean, look at the job he's doing up there at Jacksonville State right now. He's turning that program around, Paul. And I think he'd be a great fit down there.
Well, Rich Rodriguez has been a head coach at, West Virginia, Michigan, Arizona, Jacksonville State. There may have been one in between. I can't remember.
He has, but look at him now. He's totally turned that team around. I think he's starting to prove himself that he can really come back into a good Power 5 job. And I think he's going to go down there and all he's going to worry about is winning football games. None of that other bull crap that's going on down there.
Ricky, I totally agree with you in terms of he is a ball coach and he's a successful coach. And having said that, I think his chances are nil. Thanks for the call. Jace is in Augusta, Georgia. Hey, Jace.
Hey, Paul. Thanks for my call. First thing that I want to talk about was Texas A&M situation. Why are they not even considering Petrino for that job?
I'm not sure.
I mean, he's been the head coach before. I mean, yeah. He's the offensive coordinator. I don't understand why they're not even considering him as far as that goes. And another point I wanted to make was the Dogs going against Tennessee this weekend. Tennessee has no chance against the Dogs. And you can tell Legend and Jerome and Larry and Handsome Joe, they have no chance against Georgia either.
Hey, but thanks for the call. Ray is up next in Alabama. Hello, Ray.
Hey, Mr. Paul, how you doing today?
We are doing really well.
I'd like to ask you, Texas A&M, what do you think about Dabo Swinney? Would he be a good fit there?
Ray, I think he would be a good fit. I think Dabo Swinney fits that culture probably better than anyone I could come up with.
That was my chain of thought. And as Auburn, Hugh Freeze, what do you think his future is there?
I think it's very bright. I think Hugh Freeze has
turned
a pretty dire situation into one that's quite good. And I thought that win Saturday was the moment that I think you may look back on and go, man, that this is a turning point. We went on the road and we didn't just win, we destroyed the opposition. That was a big moment, I think, for the Auburn program. Tim is up next in Texas. Hello, Tim.
How you doing, Paul?
We're doing great.
Okay, good. I want to throw a name out there for the A&M job. I don't believe this name's been mentioned yet. As a Longhorn fan, this guy would be the last guy I'd want to see at Texas A&M. I believe he'd come at half the cost. There's no buyout associated. No buyout associated with him. He's a well-known high school football coach here in Texas. And like I said, he was once a thorn in the University of Texas's side. And he just so happened to, a couple of weeks ago, be cleared of all allegations against him in federal court. Can you guess who that is?
No, I can't.
The last guy I'd want to see at Texas A&M is Art Briles.
Yeah, well, Tim, he will be the last guy you see at Texas A&M because he's not getting the job.
You don't believe that that man would have a chance with the boosters, the alumni, the AD?
I just know the problems that Art Briles has had, his lack of remorse. He's the closest thing to Jim Harbaugh in terms of being a recalcitrant coach. And I cannot argue Art Briles' history, his success, what he did at Baylor, what his offense and what it brought to college football. But I'm just giving you a realistic answer, and it's a non-starter. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it very much. Let's check out Andy in Iowa. Hey, Andy, go right ahead.
Hey, how's it going, Paul?
We're doing well. Thank you.
Thank you for taking my call. I know this is SEC college program. I didn't mean to change the narrative, but I have a big announcement. There's a 5A team up here. They're going for their three-peat this coming Friday night. And it's the same team that Caden Proctor, same high school Caden Proctor graduated from.
Oh, really?
It's the Southeast Polk Rams.
And Andy, this is, are we talking high school?
Yes, sir. High school, they're going for their 5A state championship this Friday.
That is really interesting. And I think, when I was in high school, I didn't think there was anything bigger than to win the state championship. I mean, can you imagine how that would carry with you the rest of your life and the reunions and all the friendships and the brotherhood? But the idea of winning three, that's pretty astonishing.
Yeah, my son has already got a ring from last year. He hopefully he'll be getting another one.
Well, congratulations, Andy. I'm really you really touched me with that, because everybody in this audience can relate back to high school. And I mean, winning any championship, a city championship, but let alone a state championship 3 years in a row is, well, call us back and let us know how it went. Thank you very, very much. Appreciate it. Let's check out Robert in Alabama. Hey, Robert.
Hey, Paul. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yeah, Robert, you're on. Go right ahead.
Yes, sir. I'm an Alabama fan, but this situation at A&M got me thinking. I'm also a data person. Has anybody talked about the cost-benefit analysis of the, you know, how many games you're going to win based off the cost?
I have not heard that, no.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, they're going to win seven games this year. I think they won eight last year. They usually win about nine. The average SEC coach is making $6-7 million a year. Just to bring in an average coach, they're going to have to pay seven. To bring in a coach that's winning 10 games per year, they're going to have to pay $9 million a year. So, I mean, if you think about it, to gain the extra two games per year, they're going to have to pay $2.5-3 million per game, $2.5-3 million per game that they're going to gain off of this. So the cost, I mean, I can't imagine what thought process they went through of paying up to $77 million plus $2.5 million per game just of what they're going to gain off of this.
Yeah, Robert, I understand I don't understand it very well, but the data is significant. But I also think you have to factor in how broad college football programs are, what they mean to the community, what they mean to the university. And once you get over a certain line of demarcation, I think the money starts coming in exponentially. Let's take a short break. We have a lot to do on this Tuesday afternoon. We're going to talk about a moment in time. It was, 20 years ago, I believe. We'll go deep into what is an SEC story premiering tonight in just a moment.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
And welcome back. And for the clip you've been watching, it's been 25 years since one of the truly unforgettable moments in SEC football history. It was painful for Arkansas, but for Tennessee, it kept their national championship hopes alive. David Bailenson, the director of SEC Storied, True Character, joining us. David, thank you very much. I don't think I need to ask you about this compelling story, but you get a lot of ideas and you have a lot to choose from. Why did you land at this moment in time on this particular story?
Hey, Paul. Great to be on the show. I'm a big fan. I was researching football stories about University of Arkansas, and you know, anybody could do that. And, you know, Brandon's story is one of the first ones that comes up, just about him as a walk-on and everything he went through. And, you know, you quickly realize, okay, well, he died tragically after his college career ended. And as a filmmaker, you're thinking, okay, what's the ending of this, you know? And as I dug into the story further, you find out about the Sternover and the game in 1998 and Clint. And then realized, okay, well, they were both roommates. And you think to yourself, wow, there's this really unlikely connection between these two guys. One, Brandon, is sort of not your typical athlete, sort of pretty legendary story from walk-on to All-American. And Clint was kind of the opposite, you know, highly recruited out of high school, stud, two-sport athlete, comes to University of Arkansas, big bravado. And, you know, along with Houston Nutt, when he comes in, they kind of turn the program around and have this sort of storybook season that all of a sudden comes crumbling down in a matter of seconds. And, you know, like any great sports story that kind of transcends sports, you think, wow, a few seconds in your life can have crazy consequences and change things. And you think, like, that's a great entree into a story.
We know so much about Sterner, and obviously we saw Houston Nutt, but we don't know very much about Brandon. As you dug deep, tell us what you learned and how you were able to use that to make this film.
Yeah, so one of the remarkable things about Brandon's life, and I think what you'll see in this film and what makes the film unique about other stories that have been done about Brandon, is Brandon has this older brother, Marty, who is 14 years older. And Marty was actually a photographer. I mean, he's basically a documentarian. And I went to his house in Arkansas in Harrison, and you know, you go downstairs in his basement and he opens up a closet door and there's racks and rows of videotapes, Super 8 film, photographs. He'd been documenting his little brother's life from the time he was born all the way through college and that experience. And in fact, you know, he was such an advocate for his brother and they were so excited that he had made the team when he got to Arkansas. He actually got a press pass to work for the local Harrison paper, the Arkansas paper, to be able to follow the team around. And so we've got all this amazing footage that wouldn't have existed if it wasn't for Marty. And because we have this subject matter that passes away, who'd only done a handful of interviews, all of Marty's home videos and footage really helped give a voice to Brandon and help reveal his character as just this goofy, fun kid who really loves sports and was sort of this late bloomer. And you literally see this amazing physical transformation through Marty's footage of this kid who was a little bit awkward, a little bit chubby, you know, not really a typical athlete, who grows up and then slowly grows and grows and grows. And then by the time his senior year comes, he's actually a pretty big guy and a really dominant but small town athlete. And then by the time he gets to Arkansas, I mean, he transforms himself to the point where when he got to the NFL draft, I think he had, you know, one of the highest vertical leaps, fastest 40 times, you know, one of the top bench presses for any offensive lineman. So you're able to get that through this footage.
Well, I think a lot of people, they've seen the trailers and they're going, okay, here we go again. If you're an Arkansas fan, you have to relive something that's talked about. And Clint, as you know, I mean, he's been asked about it a zillion times, but that's not really what the story is about. So the season ends, and if I understand it correctly, Brandon moves on. And it gets interesting, though, the next year. So take us through Brandon, and then we'll pick it back up a year later.
Yeah, so there, you know, Brandon's a senior when Clint is a junior. In that 98 season is when he graduated. And after the sort of Sternover and the season kind of, you know, they end still with a winning record, and they had kind of turned it around from the previous couple of years of having a losing record. Brandon heads off to the draft. And is drafted in the third round for the Indianapolis Colts. And then literally 10 days later, he's driving from Arkansas, from Fayetteville home to meet his mom, and dies in a car accident on the roads of Arkansas, on the highways of Arkansas. And it's just unbelievable shock to everybody. All his teammates came to the funeral. It was, you know, really like weeks and weeks of mourning in town. But then they somehow turned it around and used it as motivation. You know, Houston Nutt had his number put on everybody's helmets. He had the locker encased in glass, which a lot of people have seen. And they made it themselves to try and come back for that 99 season. And they faced Tennessee again. This time, Arkansas's record wasn't as good, and they weren't in as good a position to win a bowl game or sort of win a national championship like they had the year before. But Tennessee was. Tennessee was a top team trying to get that national championship. And Arkansas beats them. And Clint rises to the occasion and plays an unbelievable game. In fact, by the time he was done his senior year, he basically broke all his school records. And it was sort of redemption. That's what they called it, sort of the redemption season, redeeming himself for the year before and that. And I think it's really important that Arkansas fans hold on to that game as an important game, just like they do the turnover. You know, everybody talks about the turnover, but it was important for Houston not to realize, like, hey, this 99 game was amazing. You know, we beat them. We got revenge. You know, they weren't too happy about it. And that's something that the school should and the fans of the program should, you know, be excited about, or at least be proud of, rather.
Yeah, you know, what I think is interesting is, you know, we get so hung up on the treetop stuff, David, and you forget the national championship. These things matter. And we're talking about a game the following year that I follow both schools. I didn't even realize until we started the conversation with you that Arkansas upset the number three team in the country. But I can only imagine, knowing Houston Nutt for many years and really one of the great motivators, I mean, how that must have carried into this game.
Yeah, I mean, Houston, he's an amazing guy. He has an amazing story. I mean, someone's got to do something about him, just and how he grew up and his parents and his life in sports and everything. But yeah, like I said, he had started that season. He says, we're going to call this the redemption season. We're going to do this for Burles. You know, there became this term, the Burles way, do it the Burles way, which was, you know, basing things on how Brandon, you know, did all these things the right way, even when no one was looking. And so that became this term. If you do it the Burles way, it's like, do it when no one's looking. That's like if there's trash at school, which they saw him one day after Houston had gotten mad at all the players for leaving the locker room as a mess. They came one day and saw him walking around the campus picking up trash for it. And so they all really used that motivation. And everyone who was on that team, who was Brandon's teammates, talked about how he just wanted to make them a better person. And he wasn't a guy who spoke up. He was pretty quiet. And it's rare in sports. Most leaders are really vocal, gregarious, you know, outgoing guys. And Brandon was a leader who just led by example. And they used that as motivation in that 99 season. And in that game, as Quinn says in the film, he wanted to win that game more than anything he'd ever wanted to win in his life. And they came out and they dominated. And in fact, we didn't show it in the film, but, you know, they tore the goalpost down. Carried him off the field. They chopped up the goalposts and ended up giving him out to everybody. That was one of the last times they did that. But it was a big win.
SEC story tonight, true character. David, thank you. Thank you very much. Can't wait to watch, and we appreciate your time.
Thanks.
You bet. Great stuff. What a story. We will take a short break here. We will get back to your calls, more guests as well.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
Are back, and Frank is up next in Delaware. Hey, Frank.
Good afternoon. I'm just calling in reference to the Texas A&M coaching job. Of course, I'm going number one and two, obvious, are Oregon, and number two would probably be Duke coach. But here is a long shot, and I know these Texas teams, especially A&M, they're going to be looking for a name recognition that really drawing all those recruits and everything. And I'm going to go with Urban Meyer as the new coach of that team. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a terrible choice, Frank. I mean, Urban Meyer pretty much got drummed out of Ohio State, got fired 12 games into his season, first season at Jacksonville, and He leaves a disaster everywhere he goes, and I don't think right now, in spite of his resume, A&M is looking for more headlines. Thanks for the suggestion, though. Haven't heard that one before. Glenn is up next in Florida. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, Paul. How are you? I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
You made a comment yesterday when you had Brian Kelly on and you were talking about Jaden Daniels, that he had very little chance of being or winning the Heisman due to LSU not being a national contender. And so I sat down yesterday after the show and I wrote down the stats of Jaden Daniels, and I did Bo Nix and then Michael Penix at Washington. And his stats were clearly heads or tails above both Bo Nix and Penix. And then I looked up the definition of the Heisman Trophy, and it's awarded annually to the most outstanding player in college football. Winners epitomize great ability combined with diligence, perseverance, and hard work. Nothing on there says a contender of a national championship. I know that you as a sports writer get a vote in the Heisman, but I think this is the reason why a lot of Heisman contenders that go to the NFL end up becoming busts or they don't do very well. But can you tell me why, again, you feel that Jaden Daniels, up to this point, 10 games, he has a better combined stats. The thing that was really impressive was his rushing, not just passing, but he has almost 1,000 yards rushing, which is about 900 yards more than Bo Nix and about 1,000 yards more than Michael Penix, who both are contenders in the Heisman. But can we talk about that again?
Glenn, I'll give it a shot. And I do believe this. I believe Jaden will be a finalist. And there is a, and I'm correcting something I may have said yesterday. I think there is a very narrow path for him. But I'm being honest. I'm not sugarcoating it because I'm a Brian Kelly fan or Jaden Daniels fan, which I am. I just know the way it happens. And there are some outliers. RG3, about 13 years ago, snuck in at the last minute because the field was fairly weak. He was up against, I think, Trent Richardson at Alabama. This may have been 11. And he was able to get in there. But he's going to need a perfect storm. He's going to need Penix to get maybe knocked out this weekend in terms of his team losing and him having a poor game. Maybe Bo Nix losing the championship game. He's also going to need Marvin Harrison to lose and maybe have a bad game. So I think if those three things happen, then he gets thrust back perhaps into a position where he can make some noise. But it really hurts badly for a Heisman contender, rightly or wrongly, not to be playing on the championship weekend. He's got an off-brand game on the final Saturday of the season against A&M. It's an 11 o'clock local game. It's opposite the biggest game of the year in college football. It won't be heavily watched in terms of Heisman voters. The championship weekend, he won't be on the scene. So all I'm saying to you is this. It's not impossible, but I'm using precedent and past voting to help me formulate the opinion that I think his chance of winning right now is limited. Not impossible, but limited.
Sure. No, I agree with everything that you're saying. It just seems that sometimes we all have a tunnel vision of what the winner is supposed to be, kind of like the selection committee.
Agreed.
When they pick the final four teams.
Now, one thing I'm sure LSU is thinking about is they need to campaign. And what does that mean? That means that Jaden's last game will be a week from Saturday. He needs to be seen the following week. And I think he will be. I would do this. I would take Jaden to New York. I would put him on the morning shows. I would make sure that he is seen and heard and his stats are distributed. They will be. This is pro forma. But I think if enough people campaign for him, enough people of influence. Heisman voters are primarily followers. They're not leaders. They just look up and say, okay, who's in the race? Who's leading? And I think Brian Kelly can do him a lot of good, and I think he already has. So I'm glad you brought it up. Thank you very much for the call. Let's check out Duke. calling from Georgia. Hey, Duke.
Hey, Paul. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
Love your show. I'm a first-time caller. I just had something that's been bugging me the last couple of weeks, and it's the fact I'm a Georgia guy. And, you know, with Ohio State being number one in the CFP poll and Georgia's number one in the AP and the coaches poll, and Ohio State's number three, and, you know, in the other two polls, we're getting basically just almost all the first-place votes. So it doesn't even seem to be close in the other two polls, but I just don't understand the CFP poll.
Let me explain something, Duke. Tonight, I believe very strongly Georgia will be number one. This is maybe the least talked about CFP poll I can ever remember. I've been on shows all day. I don't think it ever came up because they're just the Harbaugh story is sucking the oxygen out of the sport today. But I think they'll be number one. Whether they stay number one is another question because that Michigan-Ohio State game is so significant. But then I think Georgia can come back the next week. Even if it goes back to two, I think a win over Alabama would put them back at number one. If Georgia wins out, they'll be number one. And this week will help Georgia a little bit too. Tennessee is limping into Neyland, but it's still a very significant road win. Better than I think anything Michigan has, including the win at Penn State. We'll take a short break. We are back right after this.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.